Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
First of all, it was the Israelis who started this. Israel made a major mistake that increases the likelihood that Iran will get nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are basically a force for peace.
NATO couldn't let a European sovereign democratic country come under nuclear attack and not respond, surely.
Yes, it could. And no American president, in my opinion, is willing to sacrifice New York or Chicago or Los Angeles for Ukraine.
Sorry, but Professor,
I don't fully understand.
Let me clarify.
We're talking about nuclear weapons. We're talking about nuclear war.
Is it ever justified morally to deploy nuclear weapons?
If you use nuclear weapons to effectively murder huge numbers of civilians, you're committing a war crime.
Well, Iran's attack on Israel brought a decades-long proxy war to the brink of a red-hot conflict. But most experts in the West agreed with President Biden's verdict that it was an emphatic Israeli win. Iran looked weak, Israel looked strong again. Western allies and key Arab states rallied to Israel's defence, underscoring ties that have been sorely tested by Israel's assault on Gaza. My next guest often swims against the tide of expert consensus. He's previously argued that a nuclear Iran would make the world a safer place and that Israel is the Middle East's foremost agitator. Returning to Uncensored, delighted to welcome back Professor John Mearsheimer. Well, John, great to have you back on. First of all, your reaction to what happened when Iran attacked Israel.
Well, I was actually quite amazed that the Iranians attacked Israel. I mean, this was the first case of Iran launching missiles from its own territory and hitting Israel. And they launched a massive attack. And even though the vast majority of those missiles and drones did not get through, the fact is that they did launch this attack and some got through. And then the Israeli retaliation was actually a very small retaliation. It's quite amazing to me how minor the retaliation was. And if you look at what the consequences of this are, I think it is not good for Israeli deterrence moving forward. The Israelis care greatly about deterrence, and for deterrence to matter or to work for them, what's necessary is for Israel to have escalation dominance. If Iran and Israel get into a fight, it's essential for Israel that it dominate as the two sides go up the escalation ladder. That's what produces deterrence. But if you look at what happened in this case, there was no escalation dominance. The Iranian attack was much larger than the Israeli attack.
Well, it was, but I would counter by saying that the Iran attack was a spectacular failure in the sense that it caused almost no damage. Almost all the missiles were taken out by the Iron Dome. And actually, I would say most significantly of the whole thing was the way that neighbouring Arab countries like Jordan raced to help defend Israel. Even Saudi Arabia allowed some of its airspace to be used. We saw the UK, we saw the French and others come in as well. So there was an immediate and rapid collaborative defence of Israel against Iran's missile attack, which thwarted any real damage being done. And in their counter, Israel, you could argue, were very specifically targeted around some of the nuclear plants which Iran is believed to have, that they were making the point that they could target anywhere in Iran at will and land their missiles, as opposed to them being taken out by any kind of Iron Dome defence. So I would take issue with your categorisation that this was somehow a victory for Iran in here. I think that, what Israel did was make a very clear statement. If you want to do this, we have the capacity to strike anywhere in Iran at will, and we also have the backing of a lot of neighbouring countries.
There was never any question that Israel had the capability to hit Iran with huge numbers of missiles and aircraft. That was never in doubt. But the fact is, their retaliation involved attacking one radar. They didn't, in a sense, turn the dogs loose and really hit Iran with large numbers of missiles and rockets.
Isn't that smart? I mean, I urged them, like many people, including President Biden, I urged in a post to X that I really hope Israel shows some restraint here, but I fear that Netanyahu wouldn't. And to my pleasant surprise, on this occasion, he did show some restraint. Because I think that there's a lot of goading going on. Well, if I finish my point, I think there's a lot of goading going on right across the region against Israel. Well, let me finish my point, then I'll get your response. You know, when you see the activity of Hezbollah, of the Houthis, of what Hamas did on October the 7th, and what Iran then did in response to the attack on their consulate, there's a lot of deliberate provocation, I think, of Israel to try and goad them into an overreaction, which may then ruin their global support and sympathy. I mean, I would argue that that is at least a possibility, isn't it?
Well, first of all, it was the Israelis who started this by bombing the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The Iranians did not start this conflict that recently took place between April 1st and April 19th.
But they were there with people from Hezbollah, weren't they? So they were military leaders using the consulate to plan attacks on Israel with leaders of Hezbollah. I mean, that was why they were targeted.
Look, in international law and according to international norms, states don't attack the embassies of other states. This was considered to be a significant provocation.
Unless they're being used as military bases, which it is believed, certainly Israel argues.
No.
I don't know, but it's certainly been argued by Israel that it was being used, part of this consular area was being used as a genuine military base, in which case it becomes a legitimate target if indeed they are meeting with Hezbollah to plan attacks on Israel, isn't it?
There's no evidence that it was being used as a military base. And the fact is that if the Israelis are going to hit the Iranian embassy, the end result is the Iranians are going to retaliate. And they did retaliate. Now, I want to say a few words about that retaliation. It's very important to understand that the Americans and the Iranians orchestrated the Iranian attack so that it would be a limited attack. It would do very little damage to Israel. And the reason this is the case is that neither the Iranians or the United States wanted this conflict. And it was the Israelis who, by attacking the Iranian embassy in Damascus, dragged the Americans and the Iranians into this conflict. And what we tried to do, working with the Iranians before the attack on April 14th, and during the attack on April 14th, was to do everything possible to keep it limited and avoid escalation.
The whole issue of nuclear weapons here, interesting that you believe that if Iran was allowed to arm itself with nuclear weapons, it would make the world a safer place. Just explain why you believe that.
Well, first of all, I think from an American point of view, and certainly from an Israeli point of view, it would be all for the good if Iran did not get nuclear weapons. I think from Iran's point of view, it makes sense to have a nuclear deterrent because nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent. So I want to discriminate or distinguish between what I think is the American and Israeli perspective on one hand and what the Iranian perspective is on the other hand.
Well, what is your perspective?
Now, with regard
personally
to the question of my perspective as an American is I hope that Iran does not get nuclear weapons. And in fact, I think that Israel made a major mistake precipitating this recent conflict because it increases the likelihood that Iran will get nuclear weapons, which is not in Israel's interest. So I want to be very clear. I'm not in favor of Iran getting nuclear weapons.
So why would you think... So just on that point, just to jump in, Why would you then think the world's a safer place if you personally do not think they should be given nuclear weapons? Wouldn't it actually have the opposite effect, that if you have a regime like the one in Iran right now, the world is likely to be a far more dangerous place if they have the capacity for a nuclear attack?
No, because nuclear weapons are weapons of mass destruction. And that would make the Israelis and the Americans incredibly wary of attacking Iran, a nuclear-armed Iran, for fear that Iran would use its nuclear weapons either against us or against the Israelis. There's no question, if you go back and look at the Cold War, the fact that the United States and the Soviet Union both had nuclear weapons made the likelihood of conflict between the superpowers much less likely, because, again, these are weapons of mass destruction. So if Iran had nuclear weapons, Israel had nuclear weapons, and the United States had nuclear weapons, all three countries would be remarkably cautious in terms of approaching each other with military forces. If you have a Middle East where nobody has nuclear weapons, you can think about fighting a conventional war. And conventional war is much less deadly, for obvious reasons, than nuclear war. So the argument here is that nuclear weapons are basically a force for peace. This is not to say you could never have a nuclear war if Iran had nuclear weapons. And that, of course, is why you don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. But it is much less likely that you would have a war between Iran and Israel or Iran and the United States if Iran had nuclear weapons.
Do you think there's any likelihood of Russia deploying any of its nuclear armament? For example, if Ukraine, emboldened now by new weaponry, thanks to Congress finally passing this big bill for money for them, If that was to start pushing the Russians back, could you see a situation where Vladimir Putin might use one of his tactical nuclear weapons?
My view has long been, Piers, that if Ukraine were to start winning on the battlefield and the Russians were losing, that the end result would be that the Russians would use nuclear weapons to rescue the situation. I think the Russians view what's happening with regard to the Ukrainian war as an existential threat. And given that the Russians think it's an existential threat, if they were in deep trouble, they were losing the war in Ukraine, I think they'd turn to nuclear weapons.
I mean, doesn't that slightly fly in the face of what you've just argued, though, which is that if you have a nuclear power like Russia and you have nuclear powers like America and they've been helping Ukraine with their weaponry and so on, you have UK nuclear power, French nuclear power, why would they do that? If, as you say, if the ownership of nuclear weapons is the ultimate deterrent, why would Russia decide to risk a nuclear war with NATO, for example, if they did this? Because NATO would surely feel an absolute moral compulsion to respond in that eventuality.
No, I think what you're missing here is that Ukraine has no nuclear weapons of its own.
No, I know.
So if the Russians refuse...
That's not my argument. I know that. And in fact, you could argue that your original argument about Iran applying to Ukraine, would Russia have invaded Ukraine if Ukraine had kept its nuclear weapons and had its own deterrent? I think that would back your argument. But here, I would argue that your argument slightly falls apart, because surely Russia would not want to do that, risking retaliation from America, UK and other countries, or a full-fledged NATO response, because NATO couldn't let a European sovereign democratic country come under nuclear attack and not respond, surely.
Yes, it could. Because if we responded with nuclear weapons against Russia, Russia would then respond with nuclear weapons against the United States of America. And no American president, in my opinion, is willing to sacrifice New York or Chicago or Los Angeles for Ukraine.
So the idea that... Sorry, but Professor, you cannot honestly think that Vladimir Putin could drop a nuclear weapon on the people of Ukraine and there would be no response from America or the West.
I said there wouldn't be a nuclear response. There may be a response, but there won't be a nuclear response, because you want to remember that if we hit Russia with American nuclear weapons or Western nuclear weapons, the end result is the Russians will retaliate against us. And we do not want to be hit with nuclear weapons. This is why we don't want Ukraine to have nuclear weapons. It's why we didn't want West Germany or South Korea or Japan to have nuclear weapons during the Cold War.
East Germany, you mean, do you?
No, West Germany. We didn't want West Germany to have nuclear weapons because our great fear was that if the Soviets overran West Germany, the West Germans would use nuclear weapons, they would hit the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union would retaliate against the United States. We don't want to become involved in a nuclear war.
But then it seems if
so we're not going to fight.
Right, I understand that. But if a nuclear power like Russia can simply use its nuclear weapons with impunity and other nuclear powers do not respond, then the nuclear deterrent collapses, doesn't it? Because they've just ignored it.
No, it doesn't. It has no effect on our nuclear deterrent. Our nuclear deterrent remains intact. And the fact is the Soviet Union during the Cold War and Russia today will not attack the United States for fear that we would use our nuclear deterrent against the Soviet Union in the Cold War and Russia today. But the point is that if the Russians were to use nuclear weapons inside of Ukraine today, we would not respond with a nuclear attack on Russia because that would precipitate a general thermonuclear war. And the last thing we want is a general thermonuclear war. This is not to say we would be happy about the fact that Ukraine was hit with nuclear weapons, because we certainly would not be, and we certainly would respond in some way. But we would not respond with a nuclear strike on Russia.
How would we respond that would have any effect?
I'm not sure. It's very hard to say. I mean, even if we used simply conventional weapons, we got involved in the war with Russia, we would then have a great power war between Russia on one side and NATO on the other side, which included the United States. And once you have a great power war involving Russia versus the United States, the danger of nuclear escalation presents itself. And this, of course, is why President Biden has wisely said that under no circumstances will American military forces be introduced into the Ukraine war, because he understands that once you do that, you're out on the slippery slope. You're out on the slippery slope to nuclear escalation. And the last thing we want, as I've emphasized to you, is a nuclear war between Russia and the United States.
No, I get that. But if Russia was to use one, that is right there, the nuclear escalation that you are so keen for everyone to avoid. It's a deliberate act of nuclear provocation. And I just cannot imagine that in that eventuality,
yes,
with hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians being slaughtered with a nuclear weapon by Russia, I just cannot imagine that there would be no similar response from the West. They would have to.
I don't believe that. I don't believe that for one second.
Well, then what you're really doing, if you don't, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but aren't you painting a picture then of Russia being effectively infallible here? They can do what the hell they like.
My point to you is that if the Russians are losing in Ukraine, and Ukraine and the West are winning, the Russians, I believe, will initiate nuclear use in Ukraine. And they will do that not only because they think they are facing an existential threat, but also because they will not fear nuclear retaliation from.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
The West.
What if President Biden or Trump, whoever it may be in charge at the time, what if they preempt this by saying, if in that eventuality of Russia starting to lose the war, and it's a big if, by the way, I would clarify that, but if they were to preempt it, preemptively say, as President of the United States, warn Russia, if you use a nuclear weapon, we will help Ukraine defend itself with a nuclear weapon, then aren't they putting in the sand there a line of deterrent, which, if it gets crossed, everyone understands what happens? Isn't that the only way it actually works? The only way a deterrent actually works is if the other side believes that you're going to use the same thing, or worse.
But you're assuming that the other side, which is the Russians in this case, would believe that threat. And I don't believe they would believe that threat.
Well, I think they'd have
call
to.
America's
they'd have,
bluff.
I think if you're America, you're going to have to want them to believe that threat. You've got to want them to believe you're serious. Otherwise, I just cannot picture a situation where Russia unleash a nuclear attack on a European country and America just doesn't respond in kind. There's no deterrent there. That's basically saying to Putin, you can use your nukes whenever you want against any country you like, and we, the great superpower of the world, will just stand by and let you do it. And we may attack you conventionally, but you know, that is not going to be a like for like, and that's not going to be a deterrent, is what I think.
If you're a member of NATO, which Ukraine is not, you have an Article 5 guarantee, and you are depending on the American nuclear deterrent to provide security for you. So if a NATO country is attacked with nuclear weapons, there is some reasonable chance the United States will use nuclear weapons to defend that NATO country. But Ukraine is not a member of NATO, and Ukraine is not of great strategic importance to the United States. And therefore, the United States is not going to risk nuclear war to save Ukraine.
I mean,
it's that simple.
It wasn't a nuclear scenario, but when you look at what happened with the first invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein, Kuwait was not a member of NATO, and yet America immediately sent boots on the ground to repel Saddam from Kuwait. I'm not sure there's a massive difference between Kuwait and the influence of that to America and the West and Ukraine, a massive sovereign democratic European country. You know, it's been invaded by, illegally invaded by a nefarious power, and America didn't hesitate to kick Saddam out of Kuwait.
There's a huge difference between these two scenarios. There was no threat of nuclear war with regard to Kuwait.
No, I said it wasn't
Kuwait.
A nuclear situation.
The scenario that you're describing with regard to Ukraine involves nuclear weapons.
Let me clarify.
We're talking about nuclear weapons.
Professor,
the United States of America does not take this threat lightly.
No.
This is a threat of huge magnitude.
We're talking about getting possibly
incinerated.
I think you misheard what I said. I deliberately said it. I know it's not a nuclear situation. The point being, why should America defend Ukraine given it's not a NATO country? And I would say, well, nor was Kuwait a NATO country, but America did send boots on the ground there to kick out Saddam Hussein. Ideologically, what is the difference, actually, between defending Kuwait against Saddam and defending Ukraine against Vladimir Putin, however you end up doing it?
We're just not talking about defending Ukraine and defending Kuwait. We're talking about using nuclear weapons. We're talking about nuclear war. We're talking about the possibility of getting incinerated. This is not a matter one should take lightly. And you only use nuclear weapons under the most extreme circumstances. The United States would only use nuclear weapons if its survival was threatened. And the idea that the Russians conquering Ukraine or dropping a nuclear weapon on Ukraine threatens their survival and therefore should precipitate a nuclear war is, I think, not a smart argument. The fact is that if the Russians were to use nuclear weapons, the United States would not respond by precipitating a general nuclear war.
Then Putin wins, right?
Putin might win. That's right. And you want to remember that if you look at what's happening in the conventional war, it looks like Putin's going to win, despite the fact that we've now passed this large-scale arms package for Ukraine. Putin is likely to win.
Why is that not a terrible thing for America and the West?
Because you have to prioritize the threats that you face in the world. And the fact of the matter is that what happens in Ukraine does not matter that much to the United States. I know for people like you, this is a life and death matter. The thought of any country on the planet that the West defends losing is a major defeat and has catastrophic consequences. I mean, you felt this way about us pulling out of Afghanistan. But I think that places like Ukraine don't matter that much.
Actually, on that, I didn't really. I felt with Afghanistan, America should have kept a small military presence there to maintain some kind of order. And I think I was justified in saying that, given what's happened since. I thought throwing the country back to the Taliban was a catastrophic error of judgment, and it wouldn't have happened in the way it's happened if America kept a couple of thousand troops there, as it does all around the world in endless bases. So it seemed to me, having done many, many years of hard work in Afghanistan as a response to 9/11, to then simply just overnight throw everybody out and leave the country to the Taliban, particularly for women's rights, never mind anything else, I thought was an abrogation of America's duty and the UK.
Right, but this is your worldview, which is the United States has a responsibility to be everywhere and
not
to never
everywhere,
quit until
but
it
they should
wins.
Certainly be preserving freedom and democracy. Otherwise, why self-style yourself as leader of the free world? You either are leader of the free world, and America still has, I think, half the world's military firepower, and obviously one of the biggest economies. You either are that entity, leader of the free world, or you're not. And if you are, then what comes with that is a responsibility to protect freedom and democracy when it comes under attack from totalitarian regimes, I would think.
I think if you look at the history of American foreign policy, it's very hard to make the case that our principal goal has been to protect freedom and democracy. The United States has a rich history of overthrowing democracies around the world, and we have a rich history of siding with some of the world's biggest dictators. So this idea that we're out there protecting freedom and democracy and it's our principal goal, in my opinion, doesn't mesh with reality.
Let me ask you about the morality of nuclear weapons. Tucker Carlson was on Joe Rogan's podcast this week and said that he believed that it was effectively immoral, evil, that the Allied powers in World War II were not justified in dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which killed over 200,000 civilians. Where do you sit with the morality of this? Is it ever justified morally to deploy nuclear weapons?
Well, I think that if you use nuclear weapons to effectively murder huge numbers of civilians, you're committing a war crime. I personally believe that the firebombing of Japan, which took place before we dropped those nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and here you want to remember, Piers, that we killed more people the first night we firebombed Tokyo than we killed at either Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
Yeah.
So we were murdering huge numbers of Japanese civilians well before we dropped those nuclear weapons. I think it's a war crime. And I believe Curtis LeMay said to Robert McNamara at the time, they were both with 20th Air Force in the Pacific, that if we lost the war, they would be tried at the next set of Nuremberg trials. So I think it was a war crime. But what happens when countries get into desperate straits, and we felt we were in desperate straits at the time because we did not want to invade the Japanese home islands. We thought that the casualties would be huge. We thought it was appropriate to drop those bombs on Japan. And I think that the people who did it were fully aware that they were killing massive numbers of civilians, that this was effectively a war crime. But I think they believed that the ends justified the means.
If by dropping those bombs, as most experts would say was the case, you prevented potentially millions more people being killed, including many more civilians than died in those two bomb attacks. Is that not moral justification for doing it, in the sense of, yes, it's horrendous, yes, the loss of civilian life is appalling and unprecedented, but it will save maybe 5-10 times as many civilians getting killed in the longer run if this war goes on?
You can make that argument for sure, and many people made it at the time. I understand the argument full well, but I think the fact of the matter is you are still murdering huge numbers of civilians. And if you think murdering, I think we probably murdered about 900,000 civilians between March 10th, 1945, and mid-August 1945. If you think murdering 900,000 civilians is justified because in the long run it will save more lives, you can make that argument. But again, I still think it's committing a war crime.
Yeah, I mean, if you categorize all civilian deaths in a war like that as murder, you're effectively saying that every one of those deaths is a crime. I would not argue that what the Allies did in response to what the Nazis and the Japanese were doing was a crime, necessarily. They were responding to an existential threat to the world, including mass murder of civilians, as we saw with the Holocaust. So a response is not necessarily murder, is it? It's effectively self-defense.
The question you have to ask yourself is whether or not you think, because the Nazis were committing genocide, because the Nazis were committing mass murder in Europe, that justifies bombing German cities and purposely killing huge numbers of civilians. Do you think that lets you off the hook? That's the argument you're making. You're saying that because the Germans were so horrible, we were allowed to be horrible ourselves, but we weren't as horrible as the Germans. And furthermore, we were doing this in self-defense. That's the argument you're making.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, I understand that there are strategic imperatives for killing civilians, right? This is why we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki with nuclear weapons. We thought that it made good strategic sense and that it would save American lives, especially those GIs who would have to invade the Japanese home islands. But I still think that that is a case of war crimes. And I think that to use your rhetoric lets us off the hook.
How does any country defend itself from an existential threat like the Nazis then, by your categorization, without committing war crimes?
Well, if you look at how the Soviets, who were basically responsible for defeating the Nazis in World War II, they did not commit many war crimes in the process of defeating the Wehrmacht. It was basically a ground war where the Soviets, the Red Army, rolled up the Wehrmacht. There were no bombing of cities. There were no dropping of nuclear weapons. Now, there's no question that there was a lot of rape and pillaging, especially at the end, as the Red Army moved into Germany. But aside from that, this was not a purposeful campaign to murder huge numbers of civilians. So you can fight a war on the ground involving two armies that basically avoids the problem of bombing cities and murdering huge numbers of civilians.
What if the Nazis are bombing cities? As they were.
What do you mean? I'm not defending the Battle of Britain,
the Blitz. I mean, if they're going to send over bombers and just attack cities in the way that they did, how do you defend yourself without committing war crimes by your assessment?
Well, the British defended themselves with fighter aircraft. The RAF fended off the Luftwaffe and won the Battle of Britain. Mm. The RAF, the British, did not commit war crimes to defeat the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain. There's no question that the RAF, at different points in the war, purposely targeted German cities and purposely tried to murder large numbers of British civilians. You know the story of Bomber Harris, for sure.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened in the Battle of Britain. And my only point is, if you talk about what Bomber Harris did and the RAF did against German cities, this was a war crime. They were purposely bombing working-class areas in German cities because that they believed would maximize, that strategy would maximize the number of civilians.
Well, it wasn't as simple as that, were they? Because they were deliberately targeting industrial cities in the main, which were being used to build munitions as well. So there was a legitimate reason to target these cities. But that was the case in many cases.
That's not true.
Yes, it is.
No, but... No, I mean, what happened was that the British quickly found out, and this is what happened to us when we bombed Japan. We quickly found out that bombing economic and military targets didn't work. I could walk you through the story about the bombing of Japanese cities like Tokyo. It didn't work. And the reason we turned to bombing civilians, to killing civilians when we bombed Japan, and this was true with regard to Bomber Harris, is that bombing economic targets didn't work.
Let me... I found this conversation, as always, fascinating, Professor Meerschaum. I love having you on. It's been quite a downbeat interview, I have to say, for obvious reasons. Are you positive about the future of mankind, or are you selling at this stage?
I'm quite pessimistic about the future of international politics. I think if you look at what's going on in Ukraine and you just think about the conversation that you and I were having, it's hard to think that the future doesn't look as depressing as the present and the recent past with regard to Ukraine. If you look at the Middle East, I mean, I see no hope there. This terrible situation is just going to go on and on. The Iran-Israel case that we talked about will pop up again in the future. And if you look into the situation in East Asia, what you see is that the U.S. and the Chinese are engaged in this intense security competition where there's a real possibility of a war in the future over Taiwan or the South China Sea or the East China Sea. And then there are all sorts of other places you can look, like the Korean Peninsula, the border between India and China. And it seems like there's no end of potential war or potential conflict between the major powers in the system and even the minor powers in the international system. And then when you look inside states and you look at what's happening, if you look at what's happening to liberal democracy around the world, it's not a pretty picture. Look at the United States, look at Britain, two of the paradigmatic liberal democracies. They're both in serious trouble. So I hate to say this, but I find very few reasons to be optimistic about the future. And sometimes I think I'm glad that I was born after World War II and I lived, you know, most of my life in the 20th and early 21st century. Because when I think about moving forward, again, doesn't look like a pretty picture.
Well, you failed to give me any positivity, but I'm going to give you some because assuming the world doesn't end before the end of May, there is a very high probability that my football team, Arsenal, will be Premier League champions before the world ends. And that is a reason, Professor, to feel positive, albeit in a small way, if you're an Arsenal fan like me.
That's a very interesting perspective. And it goes to show you how important sports is for people in the modern world.
You know, there was a great manager called Bill Shankly who managed Liverpool Football Club. And he said, football's not a matter of life or death. It's far more important than that. I kind of share that view. And how ironic if the final winners of the Premier League before the world blew itself to pieces was a club named Arsenal, named after the Woolwich Arsenal military munitions base in South London. Professor Meerschaum, brilliant to have you back on. I love debating these things with you. I always feel like I learn a lot from our conversations. And I hope you come back soon. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Pierce.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.